sailed. But I must take my poor little holiday while I can. All must be economy henceforward. All hopes of Kashmir have vanished forever and ever. When you return, I shall be slaving away in some new post. And Fielding went. And in the last gutterings of Chandrapur, heaven and earth both looking like toffee, the Indian's bad fancies were confirmed. His friends encouraged them, for though they had liked the principal, they felt uneasy at his getting to know so much about their private affairs. Mahmud Ali soon declared that treachery was afoot. Hamidullah murmured, "Certainly, of late, he no longer addressed us with his former frankness," and warned Aziz not to expect too much. He and she are, after all, both members of another race. "Where are my 20,000 rupees?" he thought. He was absolutely indifferent to money, not merely generous with it, but promptly paying his debts when he could remember to do so. Yet these rupees haunted his mind because he had been tricked about them and allowed them to escape overseas like so much of the wealth of India. Cyril would marry Miss Quested, he grew certain of it, all the unexplained residue of the Marabar contributing. It was the natural conclusion of the horrible, senseless picnic, and before long he persuaded himself that the wedding had actually taken place. Chapter 37. Friends again, yet aware that they would meet no more, Aziz and Fielding went for their last ride in the Mau jungles. The floods had abated, and the Raja was officially dead, so the guest house party were departing next morning, as decorum required. What with the mourning and the festival, the visit was a failure. Fielding had scarcely seen Godbole, who promised every day to show him over the King Emperor George V High School, his main objective, but always made some excuse. This afternoon, Aziz let out what had happened. The King Emperor had been converted into a granary, and the Minister of Education did not like to admit this to his former principal. The school had been opened only last year by the agent to the Governor-General, and it still flourished on paper. He hoped to start it again before its absence was remarked and to collect its scholars before they produced children of their own. Fielding laughed at the tangle and waste of energy. But he did not travel as lightly as in the past. Education was a continuous concern to him because his income and the comfort of his family depended on it. He knew that few Indians think education good in itself, and he deplored this now on the widest grounds. He began to say something heavy on the subject of native states, but the friendliness of Aziz distracted him. This reconciliation was a success, anyhow. After the funny shipwreck, there had been no more nonsense or bitterness, and they went back laughingly to their old relationship as if nothing had happened. Now they rode between jolly bushes and rocks. Presently the ground opened into full sunlight, and they saw a grassy slope bright with butterflies, also a cobra, which crawled across doing nothing in particular and disappeared among some custard apple trees. There were round white clouds in the sky and white pools on the earth. The hills in the distance were purple. The scene was as park-like as England, but did not cease being queer. They drew rein to give the cobra elbow room, and Aziz produced a letter that he wanted to send to Miss Quested. A charming letter. He wanted to thank his old enemy for her fine behaviour 2 years back. Perfectly plain was it now that she had behaved well. "As I fell into our largest Mau tank under circumstances our other friends will relate, I thought how brave Miss Quested was, and decided to tell her so, despite my imperfect English. Through you I am happy here with my children instead of in a prison. Of that I make no doubt. My children shall be taught to speak of you with the greatest affection and respect."
"Miss Quested will be greatly pleased. I am glad you have seen her courage at last."
"I want to do kind actions all round and wipe out the wretched business of the Marabar forever. I have been so disgracefully hasty, thinking you meant to get hold of my money. As bad a mistake as the cave itself."
Chapter 5.
The bridge party was not a success. At least, it was not what Mrs. Moore and Miss Quested were accustomed to consider a successful party. They arrived early, since it was given in their honour, but most of the Indian guests had arrived even earlier and stood massed at the further side of the tennis lawns, doing nothing.
"It is only just 5," said Mrs. Turton. "My husband will be up from his office in a moment and start the thing. I have no idea what we have to do. It's the first time we've ever given a party like this at the club. Mr. Heslop, when I'm dead and gone, will you give parties like this? It's enough to make the old type of Burrasab turn in his grave."
Ronnie laughed deferentially.
"You wanted something not picturesque, and we've provided it," he remarked to Miss Quested. "What do you think of the Aryan brother in a topi and spats?"
Neither she nor his mother answered. They were gazing rather sadly over the tennis lawn. No, it was not picturesque. The east, abandoning its secular magnificence, was descending into a valley whose further side no man can see.
"The great point to remember is that no one who is here matters. Those who matter don't come. Isn't that so, Mrs. Turton?"
"Absolutely true," said the great lady, leaning back.
She was saving herself up, as she called it, not for anything that would happen that afternoon or even that week, but for some vague future occasion when a high official might come along and tax her social strength. Most of her public appearances were marked by this air of reserve. Assured of her approbation, Ronnie continued,
"The educated Indians will be no good to us if there's a row. It's simply not worthwhile conciliating them. That's why they don't matter. Most of the people you see are seditious at heart, and the rest run squealing. The cultivator, he's another story. The Pathan, he's a man, if you like. But these people don't imagine they're India."
He pointed to the dusky line beyond the court, and here and there it flashed a pince-nez or shuffled a shoe, as if aware that he was despising it. European costume had lighted like a leprosy. Few had yielded entirely, but none were untouched. There was a silence when he had finished speaking, on both sides of the court. At least, more ladies joined the English group, but their words seemed to die as soon as uttered. Some kites hovered overhead, impartial. Over the kites passed the mass of a vulture, and with an impartiality exceeding all, the sky, not deeply coloured but translucent, poured light from its whole circumference. It seemed unlikely that the series stopped here. Beyond the sky, must not there be something that overarches all the skies, more impartial even than they? Beyond which again... They spoke of Cousin Kate. They had tried to reproduce their own attitude to life upon the stage and to dress up as the middle-class English people they actually were. Next year they would do Quality Street or The Yeoman of the Guard. Save for this annual incursion, they left literature alone. The men had no time for it. The women did nothing that they could not share with the men. Their ignorance of the arts was notable, and they lost no opportunity of proclaiming it to one another. It was the public school attitude, flourishing more vigorously than it can yet hope to do in England. If Indians were shop, the arts were bad form, and Ronnie had repressed his mother when she inquired after his viola. A viola was almost a demerit, and certainly not the sort of instrument one mentioned in public. She noticed now how tolerant and conventional his judgments had become. When they had seen Cousin Kate in London together in the past, he had scorned it. Now he pretended that it was a good play in order to hurt nobody's feelings. An unkind notice had appeared in the local paper, the sort of thing no white man could have written, as Mrs. Leslie said. Could one offer the visitors unripe mangoes in a fool?
I speak now as a doctor. No.
Then the old man said,
But I will send you up a few healthy sweets. I will give myself that pleasure.
Miss Quested, Professor Godbole's sweets are delicious, said Aziz sadly, for he wanted to send sweets too, and had no wife to cook them. They will give you a real Indian treat. Ah, in my poor position I can give you nothing.
I don't know why you say that. when you have so kindly asked us to your house?"
He thought again of his bungalow with horror. Good heavens! The stupid girl had taken him at his word. What was he to do?
Yes, all that is settled, he cried. I invite you all to see me in the Marabout Caves.
I shall be delighted.
Oh, that is a most magnificent entertainment compared to my poor sweets. But has not Miss Quested visited our caves already?
No, I have not even heard of them.
Not heard of them?
Both cried. The Marabar Caves in the Marabar Hills?
We hear nothing interesting up at the club, only tennis and ridiculous gossip.
The old man was silent, perhaps feeling that it was unseemly of her to criticize her race, perhaps fearing that if he agreed, she would report him for disloyalty. But the young man uttered a rapid, "I know."
Then tell me everything you will, or I shall never understand India. Are they the hills I sometimes see in the evening? What are these caves?
Aziz undertook to explain, but it presently appeared that he had never visited the caves himself, had always been meaning to go, but work or private business had prevented him, and they were so far. Professor Godbole chaffed him pleasantly.
My dear young sir, the pot and the kettle. Have you ever heard that useful proverb?
Are they large caves?
She asked.
No, not large.
Do describe them, Professor Godbole.
It will be a great honour.
He drew up his chair, and an expression of tension came over his face. Taking the cigarette box, she offered to him and to Aziz, and lit up herself. After an impressive pause, he said,
There is an entrance in the rock which you enter, and through the entrance is the cave.
Something like the caves at Elephanta?
Oh, no, not at all. At Elephanta, there are sculptures of Shiva and Parvati. There are no sculptures at Marabar.
They are immensely holy, no doubt, said Aziz, to help on the narrative.
Oh, no, oh, no.
Still, they are ornamented in some way.
Oh, no.
Well, why are they so famous? We all talk of the famous Marabar Caves. Perhaps that is our empty brag.
No, I should not quite say that.
Describe them to this lady, then.
It will be a great pleasure.
He forewent the pleasure, and Aziz realized that he was keeping back something about the caves. He realized because he often suffered from similar inhibitions himself. Aziz presented an expressionless face to the thermometer.
Your hand also, please.
He took it, gazed at the flies on the ceiling, and finally announced,
Some temperature.
I think not much,
said Ram Chand, desirous of fomenting trouble.
Some. He should remain in bed,
repeated Dr. Panalal, and shook the thermometer down so that its altitude remained forever unknown. He loathed his young colleague since the disasters with Dapple, and he would have liked to do him a bad turn and report to Major Callender that he was shamming. But he might want a day in bed himself soon. Besides, though Major Callender always believed the worst of natives, he never believed them when they carried tales about one another. Sympathy seemed the safer course.
How is stomach? He inquired. How head?
And catching sight of the empty cup, he recommended a milk diet.
This is a great relief to us. It is very good of you to call, Dr. Saab, said Hamidullah, buttering him up a bit.
It is only my duty.
We know how busy you are.
Yes, that is true.
And how much illness there is in the city.
The doctor suspected a trap in this remark. If he admitted that there was or was not illness, either statement might be used against him.
There is always illness, he replied, and I am always busy. It is a doctor's nature.
He has not a minute. He is due double sharp at Government College now, said Ram Chand.
You attend Professor Godbole there, perhaps?
The doctor looked professional and was silent.
We hope his diarrhea is ceasing.
He progresses, but not from diarrhea.
We are in some anxiety over him. He and Dr. Aziz are great friends. If you could tell us the name of his complaint, we should be grateful to you.
After a cautious pause, he said,
Hemorrhoids.
And so much, my dear Rafi, for your cholera, hooted Aziz, unable to restrain himself.
Cholera? Cholera? What next? What now? Cried the doctor, greatly fussed. Who spread such untrue reports about my patients?
Hamidullah pointed to the culprit.
I hear cholera, I hear bubonic plague, I hear every species of lie. Where will it end, I ask myself sometimes. This city is full of misstatements, and the originators of them ought to be discovered and punished authoritatively.
Rafi, do you hear that? Now, why do you stuff us up with all this humbug?
The schoolboy murmured that another boy had told him, also that the bad English grammar the government obliged them to use often gave the wrong meaning for words, and so led scholars into mistakes.
There is no reason you should bring a charge against a doctor, said Ramchand.
Exactly, exactly, agreed
Hamidullah, anxious to avoid an unpleasantness. Quarrels spread so quickly and so far, and Messrs. Syed Mohammed and Huck looked cross and ready to fly out.
You must apologize properly, Rafi. I can see your uncle wishes it, he said. You have not yet said that you are sorry for the trouble you have caused this gentleman by your carelessness.
It is only a boy, said
Dr. Panalal, appeased.
Even boys must learn, said Ramchand.
Your own son failing to pass the lower standard, I think, said Syed Mohammed suddenly.
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes, perhaps. He has not the advantage of a relative in the prosperity printing press.
Nor you the advantage of conducting their cases in the courts any longer.
Their voices rose. They attacked one another with obscure allusions and had a silly quarrel. Hamidullah and the doctor tried to make peace between them. In the midst of the din, someone said,
I say, is he ill or isn't he ill?
Life went on as usual, but had no consequences. That is to say, sounds did not echo or thoughts develop. Everything seemed cut off at its root, and therefore infected with illusion. For instance, there were some mounds by the edge of the track, low, serrated, and touched with whitewash. What were these mounds? Graves? Breasts of the goddess Parvati? The villagers beneath gave both replies. Again, there was a confusion about a snake which was never cleared up. Miss Quested saw a thin, dark object reared on end at the further side of a watercourse and said,
A snake!
The villagers agreed, and Aziz explained, Yes, a black cobra, very venomous, who had reared himself up to watch the passing of the elephant. But when she looked through Ronnie's field glasses, she found it wasn't a snake, but the withered and twisted stump of a toddy palm. So she said,
It isn't a snake.
The villagers contradicted her. She had put the word into their minds, and they refused to abandon it. Aziz admitted that it looked like a tree through the glasses, but insisted that it was a black cobra really, and improvised some rubbish about protective mimicry. Nothing was explained, and yet there was no romance. Films of heat radiated from the Kawadol precipices increased the confusion. They came at irregular intervals and moved capriciously. A patch of field would jump as if it was being fried, and then lie quiet. As they drew closer, the radiation stopped. The elephant walked straight at the Kawadol as if she would knock for admission with her forehead, then swerved and followed a path round its base. The stones plunged straight into the earth, like cliffs into the sea, and while Miss Quested was remarking on this and saying that it was striking, the plain quietly disappeared, peeled off, so to speak, and nothing was to be seen on either side but the granite, very dead and quiet. The sky dominated as usual, but seemed unhealthily near, adhering like a ceiling to the summits of the precipices. It was as if the contents of the corridor had never been changed. Occupied by his own munificence, Aziz noticed nothing. His guest noticed a little. They did not feel that it was an attractive place or quite worth visiting, and wished it could have turned into some Mohammedan object such as a mosque, which their host would have appreciated and explained. His ignorance became evident and was really rather a drawback. In spite of his gay, confident talk, he had no notion how to treat this particular aspect of India. He was lost in it without Professor Godbole, like themselves. The corridor narrowed, then widened into a sort of tray. Here, more or less, was their goal. A ruined tank held a little water, which would do for the animals, and close above the mud was punched a black hole, the first of the caves. Three hills encircled the tray. Two of them pumped out heat busily, but the third was in shadow, and here they camped.
"A horrid, stuffy place, really," murmured Mrs. Moore to herself.
"How quick your servants are,"
Miss Quested exclaimed. For a cloth had already been laid with a vase of artificial flowers in its centre, and Mahmud Ali's butler offered them poached eggs and tea for the second time.
"I thought we would eat this before our caves and breakfast after."
"Isn't this breakfast?"
"This breakfast? Did you think I should treat you so strangely?"
He had been warned that English people never stop eating, and that he had better nourish them every 2 hours until a solid meal was ready.
"How very well it is all arranged."
"That you shall tell me when we return to Chandrapur. Whatever disgraces I bring upon myself, you remain my guests."
He spoke gravely now. They were dependent on him for a few hours, and he felt grateful to them for placing themselves in such a position. All was well so far. The elephant held a fresh-cut bough to her lips, the tonga shaft stuck up into the air, the kitchen boy peeled potatoes, Hassan shouted, and Muhammad Latif stood as he ought with a peeled switch in his hand. He mentioned one or two names, men from a distance who would not be intimidated by local conditions, and said he should prefer Amrit Rao, a Calcutta barrister who had a high reputation professionally and personally, but who was notoriously anti-British. Fielding demurred. This seemed to him going to the other extreme. Aziz must be cleared, but with a minimum of racial hatred. Amrit Rao was loathed at the club. His retention would be regarded as a political challenge.
"Oh no, we must hit with all our strength. When I saw my friend's private papers carried in just now in the arms of a dirty policeman, I said to myself, Amrit Rao is the man to clear up this."
There was a lugubrious pause. The temple bell continued to jangle harshly. The interminable and disastrous day had scarcely reached its afternoon. Continuing their work, the wheels of dominion now propelled a messenger on a horse from the superintendent to the magistrate with an official report of the arrest.
"Don't complicate. Let the cards play themselves," entreated Fielding, as he watched the man disappear into dust. "We are bound to win. There's nothing else we can do. She will never be able to substantiate the charge."
This comforted Hamidullah, who remarked with complete sincerity,
"At a crisis, the English are really unequalled."
"Goodbye then, my dear Hamidullah. We must drop the mister now. Give Aziz my love when you see him, and tell him to keep calm, calm, calm. I shall go back to the college now. If you want me, ring me up. If you don't, don't, for I shall be very busy."
"Goodbye, my dear Fielding. And you actually are on our side against your own people?"
"Yes, definitely."
He regretted taking sides. To slink through India unlabeled was his aim. Henceforward he would be called anti-British, seditious, terms that bored him and diminished his utility. He foresaw that besides being a tragedy, there would be a muddle. Already he saw several tiresome little knots, and each time his eye returned to them, they were larger. Born in freedom, he was not afraid of muddle, but he recognized its existence. This section of the day concluded in a queer, vague talk with Professor Godbole. The interminable affair of the Russell's Viper was again in question. Some weeks before, one of the masters at the college, an unpopular Parsee, had found a Russell's Viper nosing round his classroom. Perhaps it had crawled in of itself, but perhaps it had not, and the staff still continued to interview their principal about it and to take up his time with their theories. The reptile is so poisonous that he did not like to cut them short, and this they knew. Thus, when his mind was bursting with other troubles, and he was debating whether he should compose a letter of appeal to Miss Quested, he was obliged to listen to a speech which lacked both basis and conclusion, and floated through air. She was the English girl who had had the terrible experience, and for whom too much could not be done. No one, except Ronnie, had any idea of what passed in her mind, and he only dimly, for where there is officialism, every human relationship suffers. In her sadness she said to him,
"I bring you nothing but trouble. I was right on the Maidan. We had better just be friends."
But he protested, for the more she suffered, the more highly he valued her. Did she love him? This question was somehow draggled up with the Marabar. It had been in her mind as she entered the fatal cave. Was she capable of loving anyone?
"Miss Quested, Adela, what do you call yourself? It's 7:30. We ought to think of starting for that court when you feel inclined."
"She's saying her prayers," came the collector's voice.
"Sorry, my dear, take your time. Was your Chota Hazri all right?" "I can't eat. Might I have a little brandy?" she asked, deserting Jehovah.
When it was brought, she shuddered and said she was ready to go.
"Drink it up. Not a bad notion, a peg."
"I don't think it'll really help me, Burisab."
"You sent brandy down to the court, didn't you, Mary?"
"I should think I did. A champagne, too."
"I'll thank you this evening. I'm all to pieces now," said the girl, forming each syllable carefully, as if her trouble would diminish if it were accurately defined.
She was afraid of reticence, in case something that she herself did not perceive took shape beneath it. And she had rehearsed with Mr. McBride, in an odd, mincing way, her terrible adventure in the cave, how the man had never actually touched her, but dragged her about, and so on. Her aim this morning was to announce, meticulously, that the strain was appalling, and she would probably break down under Mr. Amrit Rao's cross-examination and disgrace her friends.
"My echo has come back again badly," she told them.
"How about aspirin?"
"It is not a headache, it is an echo."
Unable to dispel the buzzing in her ears, Major Callender had diagnosed it as a fancy, which must not be encouraged. So the Turtons changed the subject. The cool little lick of the morning breeze was passing over the earth, dividing night from day. It would fail in 10 minutes, but they might profit by it for their drive down into the city.
"I am sure to break down," she repeated.
"You won't," said the collector, his voice full of tenderness.
"Of course she won't. She's a real sport." "But Mrs. Turton..."
"Yes, my dear child."
"If I do break down, it is of no consequence. It would matter in some trials, not in this. I put it to myself in the following way. I can really behave as I like, cry, be absurd. I am sure to get my verdict, unless Mr. Dass is most frightfully unjust."
"You're bound to win," he said calmly,
and did not remind her that there was bound to be an appeal. When the whirring of action ceases, it becomes visible and reveals a civilization which the West can disturb but will never acquire. The hand stretches out forever. The lifted knee has the eternity, though not the sadness, of the grave. Aziz was full of civilization this evening, complete, dignified, rather hard, and it was with diffidence that the other said,
"Yes, certainly. You must let off Miss Quested easily. She must pay all your costs, that is only fair, but do not treat her like a conquered enemy."
"Is she wealthy? I depute you to find out."
"The sums mentioned at dinner, when you all got so excited, they would ruin her. They are perfectly preposterous. Look here."
"I am looking, though it gets a bit dark.
I see Cyril Fielding to be a very nice chap indeed, and my best friend, but in some ways a fool. You think that by letting Miss Quested off easily, I shall make a better reputation for myself and Indians generally. No, no. It will be put down to weakness and the attempt to gain promotion officially. I have decided to have nothing more to do with British India, as a matter of fact. I shall seek service in some Muslim state, such as Hyderabad, Bhopal, where Englishmen cannot insult me any more. Don't counsel me otherwise."
"In the course of a long talk with Miss Quested..."
"I don't want to hear your long talks.
Be quiet. In the course of a long talk with Miss Quested, I have begun to understand her character. It's not an easy one, she being a prig, but she is perfectly genuine and very brave. When she saw she was wrong, she pulled herself up with a jerk and said so. I want you to realize what that means. All her friends around her, the entire British Raj pushing her forward. She stops, sends the whole thing to smithereens. In her place, I should have funked it. But she stopped, and almost did she become a national heroine. But my students ran us down a side street before the crowd caught flame. Do treat her considerately. She really mustn't get the worst of both worlds. I know what all these, he indicated the shrouded forms on the roof, will want, but you mustn't listen to them. Be merciful. Act like one of your six Mughal emperors, or all the six rolled into one. Not even Mughal emperors showed mercy until they received an apology. She'll apologize if that's the trouble, he cried, sitting up. Look, I'll make you an offer. Dictate to me whatever form of words you like, and this time tomorrow I'll bring it back signed. This is not instead of any public apology she may make you in law. It's an addition. Dear Dr. Aziz, I wish you had come into the cave. I am an awful old hag, and it is my last chance. Will she sign that?
Well, good night, good night. It's time to go to sleep after that.
Good night. I suppose it is.
Oh, I wish you wouldn't make that kind of remark, he continued after a pause. It is the one thing in you I can't put up with.
I put up with all things in you, so what is to be done?
Well, you hurt me by saying it. Good night.
Chapter 32. Egypt was charming. A green strip of carpet, and walking up and down it four sorts of animals and one sort of man. Fielding's business took him there for a few days. He re-embarked at Alexandria, bright blue sky, constant wind, clean, low coastline, as against the intricacies of Bombay. Crete welcomed him next with the long, snowy ridge of its mountains, and then came Venice. As he landed on the Piazzetta, a cup of beauty was lifted to his lips, and he drank with a sense of disloyalty. The buildings of Venice, like the mountains of Crete and the fields of Egypt, stood in the right place, whereas in poor India, everything was placed wrong. He had forgotten the beauty of form among idle temples and lumpy hills. Indeed, without form, how can there be beauty? Form stammered here and there in a mosque, became rigid through nervousness even. But oh, these Italian churches! San Giorgio, standing on the island which could scarcely have risen from the waves without it. The Salute, holding the entrance of a canal which, but for it, would not be the Grand Canal. In the old undergraduate days he had wrapped himself up in the many-coloured blanket of St. Mark's. But something more precious than mosaics and marbles was offered to him now. The harmony between the works of man and the earth that upholds them, the civilization that has escaped muddle, the spirit in a reasonable form, with flesh and blood subsisting. Writing picture postcards to his Indian friends, he felt that all of them would miss the joys he experienced now, the joys of form, and that this constituted a serious barrier. They would see the sumptuousness of Venice, not its shape, and though Venice was not Europe, it was part of the Mediterranean harmony. The Mediterranean is the human norm. When men leave that exquisite lake, whether through the Bosphorus or the Pillars of Hercules, they approach the monstrous and extraordinary. And the southern exit leads to the strangest experience of all. Turning his back on it yet again, he took the train northward, and tender, romantic fancies that he thought were dead forever flowered when he saw the buttercups and daisies of June.
Aziz, I wish you would talk to my wife. She too believes that the Marabar is wiped out.
How so?
I don't know. Perhaps she might tell you. She won't tell me. She has ideas I don't share. Indeed, when I'm away from her, I think them ridiculous. When I'm with her, I suppose because I'm fond of her, I feel different. I feel half deaf and half blind. My wife's after something. You and I and Miss Quested are, roughly speaking, not after anything. We jog on as decently as we can, you a little in front, a laudable little party, but my wife is not with us.
What are you meaning? Is Stella not faithful to you, Cyril? This fills me with great concern.
Fielding hesitated. He was not quite happy about his marriage. He was passionate physically again, the final flare-up before the clinkers of middle age, and he knew that his wife did not love him as much as he loved her, and he was ashamed of pestering her. But during the visit to Mao, the situation had improved. There seemed a link between them at last, that link outside either participant that is necessary to every relationship. In the language of theology, their union had been blessed. He could assure Aziz that Stella was not only faithful to him, but likely to become more so. And trying to express what was not clear to himself, he added dully that different people had different points of view.
If you won't talk about the Marabout to Stella, why won't you talk to Ralph? He is a wise boy, really, and, same metaphor, he rides a little behind her, though with her.
Tell him also, I have nothing to say to him, but he is indeed a wise boy, and has always one Indian friend. I partly love him because he brought me back to you to say goodbye.
For this is goodbye, Cyril, though to think about it will spoil our ride and make us sad.
No, we won't think about it.
He too felt that this was their last free intercourse. All the stupid misunderstandings had been cleared up, but socially they had no meeting place. He had thrown in his lot with Anglo-India by marrying a countrywoman, and he was acquiring some of its limitations, and already felt surprise at his own past heroism. Would he today defy all his own people for the sake of a stray Indian? Aziz was a memento, a trophy. They were proud of each other, yet they must inevitably part. And anxious to make what he could of this last afternoon, he forced himself to speak intimately about his wife, the person most dear to him. He said,
"From her point of view, Mao has been a success. It calmed her. Both of them suffer from restlessness. She found something soothing, some solution of her queer troubles here."
After a silence, myriads of kisses around them as the earth drew the water in, he continued,
"Do you know anything about this Krishna business?"
"My dear chap, officially they call it Gokul Ashtami. All the state offices are closed. But how else should it concern you and me?"
"Gokul is the village where Krishna was born. Well, more or less born, for there's the same hovering between it and another village as between Bethlehem and Nazareth. What I want to discover is its spiritual side, if it has one."
The play was praised, to be sure, and so were the stage management and the performance as a whole. But the notice contained the following sentence. "Miss Derrick, though she charmingly looked her part, lacked the necessary experience and occasionally forgot her words." This tiny breath of genuine criticism had given deep offence, not indeed to Miss Derrick, who was as hard as nails, but to her friends. Miss Derrick did not belong to Chandrapur. She was stopping for a fortnight with the McBrides, the police people, and she had been so good as to fill up a gap in the cast at the last moment. A nice impression of local hospitality she would carry away with her.
"To work, Mary, to work,"
cried the collector, touching his wife on the shoulder with a switch. Mrs. Turton got up awkwardly.
"What do you want me to do? Oh, those Purdah women. I never thought any would come. Oh, dear."
A little group of Indian ladies had been gathering in a third quarter of the grounds, near a rustic summer-house, in which the more timid of them had already taken refuge. The rest stood with their backs to the company, and their faces pressed into a bank of shrubs. At a little distance stood their male relatives watching the venture. The sight was significant, an island bared by the turning tide and bound to grow.
"I consider they ought to come over to me."
"Oh, come along, Mary, get it over."
"I refuse to shake hands with any of the men, unless it has to be the Nawab Bahadur."
Whom have we so far? He glanced along the line. Much as one expected. We know why he is here, I think, over that contract. And he wants to get the right side of me for Murrum. And he's the astrologer who wants to dodge the municipal building regulations. And he's that Parsee. And he's... Hello? There he goes. Smash into our hollyhocks. Pulled the left rein when he meant the right. All as usual.
They ought never to have been allowed to drive in. It's so bad for them, said Mrs. Turton, who had at last begun her progress to the summer house, accompanied by Mrs. Moore, Miss Quested, and a terrier.
Why they come at all, I don't know. They hate it as much as we do. Talk to Mrs. McBride. Her husband made her give purda parties until she struck.
This isn't a purda party, corrected Miss Quested.
Oh, really?
Was the haughty rejoinder.
Do kindly tell us who these ladies are, asked Mrs. Moore.
You're superior to them anyway, don't forget that. You're superior to everyone in Ender, except one or two of the Ranis, and they're on an equality.
Advancing, she shook hands with the group and said a few words of welcome in Urdu. She had learnt the lingo, but only to speak to her servants, so she knew none of the politer forms, and of the verbs, only the imperative mood. As soon as her speech was over, she inquired of her companions,
"Is that what you wanted?"
"Please tell these ladies that I wish we could speak their language, but we have only just come to their country."
"Perhaps we speak yours a little,"
one of the ladies said.
"Why, fancy, she understands," said Mrs. Turton.
"Eastbourne, Piccadilly, Hyde Park Corner," said another of the ladies.
"Oh, yes, they're English-speaking."
"But now we can talk. How delightful," cried Adela, her face lighting up.
"She knows Paris also,"
called one of the onlookers.
"They pass Paris on the way, no doubt,"
said Mrs. Turton, as if she was describing the movements of migratory birds. Her manner had grown more distant since she had discovered that some of the group was westernized and might apply her own standards to her.
"The shorter lady, she is my wife. She is Mrs. Bhattacharya," the onlooker explained. "The taller lady, she is my sister. She is Mrs. Das."
The shorter and the taller ladies both adjusted their saris and smiled. There was a curious uncertainty about their gestures, as if they sought for a new formula which neither East nor West could provide.
End of Disc 1. Please continue with the next disc.
Sometimes, to the exasperation of Major Callender, he would pass over the one relevant fact in a position to dwell on the 100 irrelevant. The Major accused him of disingenuousness, and was roughly right, but only roughly. It was rather that a power he couldn't control capriciously silenced his mind. Godbole's had been silenced now. No doubt, not willingly, he was concealing something. Handled subtly, he might regain control and announce that the Marabar caves were full of stalactites, perhaps. Aziz led up to this, but they weren't. The dialogue remained light and friendly, and Adela had no conception of its underdrift. She did not know that the comparatively simple mind of the Mohammedan was encountering ancient night. Aziz played a thrilling game. He was handling a human toy that refused to work. He knew that much. If it worked, neither he nor Professor Godbole would be the least advantaged, but the attempt enthralled him and was akin to abstract thought. On he chattered, defeated at every move by an opponent who would not even admit that a move had been made, and further than ever from discovering what, if anything, was extraordinary about the Marabar Caves. Into this, Ronnie dropped. With an annoyance he took no trouble to conceal, he called from the garden,
"What's happened to Fielding? Where's my mother?"
"Good evening," she replied coolly.
"I want you and mother at once. There's to be polo."
"I thought there was to be no polo."
"Everything's altered. Some soldier men have come in. Come along,
and I'll tell you about it.
Your mother will return shortly, sir, said Professor Godbole, who had risen with deference. There is but little to see at our poor college.
Ronnie took no notice, but continued to address his remarks to Adela. He had hurried away from his work to take her to see the polo, because he thought it would give her pleasure. He did not mean to be rude to the two men, but the only link he could be conscious of with an Indian was the official, and neither happened to be his subordinate. As private individuals, he forgot them. Unfortunately, Aziz was in no mood to be forgotten. He would not give up the secure and intimate note of the last hour. He had not risen with Godbole, and now, offensively friendly, called from his seat,
"Come along up and join us, Mr. Heslop. Sit down till your mother turns up."
Ronnie replied by ordering one of Fielding's servants to fetch his master at once.
"He may not understand that. Allow me."
Aziz repeated the order idiomatically. Ronnie was tempted to retort. He knew the type. He knew all the types. And this was the spoilt westernized. But he was a servant of the government. It was his job to avoid incidents. So he said nothing and ignored the provocation that Aziz continued to offer. Aziz was provocative. Everything he said had an impertinent flavour, or jarred. His wings were failing, but he refused to fall without a struggle. He did not mean to be impertinent to Mr. Heslop, who had never done him harm. But here was an Anglo-Indian who must become a man before comfort could be regained. He did not mean to be greasily confidential to Miss Quested, only to enlist her support, nor to be loud and jolly towards Professor Godbole. A strange quartet. He fluttering to the ground, she puzzled by the sudden ugliness, Ronnie fuming, the Brahmin observing all three, but with downcast eyes and hands folded, as if nothing was noticeable. A scene from a play, thought Fielding, who now saw them from the distance across the garden, grouped among the blue pillars of his beautiful hall.
End of disc 2. Please continue with the next disc.
Mr. Fielding had entered unobserved. All rose to their feet, and her son, to do an Englishman honour, struck with a sugar cane at the coil of flies.
Aziz said, "Sit down," coldly.
What a room! What a meeting! Squalor and ugly talk, the floor strewn with fragments of cane and nuts and spotted with ink, the pictures crooked upon the dirty walls, no punkah. He hadn't meant to live like this or among these third-rate people, and in his confusion he thought only of the insignificant ruffy whom he had laughed at and allowed to be teased. The boy must be sent away happy, or hospitality would have failed along the whole line.
"It is good of Mr. Fielding to condescend to visit our friend," said the police inspector. "We are touched by this great kindness."
"Don't talk to him like that. He doesn't want it, and he doesn't want three chairs. He's not three Englishmen," he flashed. "Rafi, come here. Sit down again. I'm delighted you could come with Mr. Hamidullah, my dear boy. It will help me to recover seeing you."
"Forgive my mistakes," said Rafi, to consolidate himself.
"Well, are you ill, Aziz, or aren't you?"
Fielding repeated.
"No doubt Major Callender has told you that I am shamming."
"Well, are you?"
The company laughed, friendly and pleased. An Englishman at his best, they thought, so genial.
"Inquire from Dr. Panalal."
"You're sure I don't tire you by stopping?"
"Why, no. There are six people present in my small room already. Please remain seated, if you will excuse the informality."
He turned away and continued to address Rafi, who was terrified at the arrival of his principal, remembered that he had tried to spread slander about him, and yearned to get away.
"He is ill, and he is not ill," said Hamidullah, offering a cigarette, "and I suppose that most of us are in the same case."
Fielding agreed. He and the pleasant, sensitive barrister got on well. They were fairly intimate and beginning to trust each other.
"The whole world looks to be dying. Still, it doesn't die. So we must assume the existence of a beneficent providence."
"Oh, that is true. How true,"
said the policeman, thinking religion had been praised.
"Does Mr. Fielding think it's true?"
"Think which true?
The world isn't dying, I'm certain of that.
No, the existence of Providence.
I don't believe in Providence.
But how then can you believe in God? Asked Sayyid Mohammed.
I don't believe in God. A tiny movement as of I told you so passed round the company, and Aziz looked up for an instant, scandalized.
Is it correct that most are atheists in England now? Hamidullah inquired.
The educated, thoughtful people, I should say so, though they don't like the name. The truth is that the West doesn't bother much over belief and disbelief in these days. 50 years ago, or even when you and I were young, much more fuss was made.
And does not morality also decline?
It depends what you call... Yes, I suppose morality does decline.
The expedition was a success, and it was Indian. An obscure young man had been allowed to show courtesy to visitors from another country, which is what all Indians long to do, even cynics like Mahmud Ali, but they never have the chance. Hospitality had been achieved. They were his guests. His honour was involved in their happiness, and any discomfort they endured would tear his own soul. Like most Orientals, Aziz overrated hospitality, mistaking it for intimacy, and not seeing that it is tainted with the sense of possession. It was only when Mrs. Moore or Fielding was near him that he saw further, and knew that it is more blessed to receive than to give. These two had strange and beautiful effects on him. They were his friends, his forever, and he theirs forever. He loved them so much that giving and receiving became one. He loved them even better than the Hamidullahs, because he had surmounted obstacles to meet them, and this stimulates a generous mind. Their images remain somewhere in his soul up to his dying day, permanent additions. He looked at her now as she sat on a deck chair sipping his tea, and had for a moment a joy that held the seeds of its own decay, for it would lead him to think, "Oh, what more can I do for her?" And so back to the dull round of hospitality. The black bullets of his eyes filled with soft, expressive light, and he said, "Do you ever remember our mosque, Mrs. Moore?"
I do, she said, suddenly vital and young. "And how rough and rude I was, and how good you were, and how happy we both were.
Friendships last longest that begin like that, I think. Shall I ever entertain your other children?"
"Do you know about the others? She will never talk about them to me," said Miss Quested,
unintentionally breaking a spell. "Ralph and Stella, yes, I know everything about them. But we must not forget to visit our caves. One of the dreams of my life is accomplished in having you both here as my guests. You cannot imagine how you have honoured me. I feel like the Emperor Babur."
"Why like him?" she inquired, rising.
"Because my ancestors came down with him from Afghanistan. They joined him at Herat. He also had often no more elephants than one, none sometimes, but he never ceased showing hospitality. When he fought or hunted or ran away, he would always stop for a time among hills, just like us. He would never let go of hospitality and pleasure. And if there was only a little food, he would have it arranged nicely. And if only one musical instrument, he would compel it to play a beautiful tune. I take him as my ideal. He is the poor gentleman, and he became a great king."
"I thought another emperor is your favourite. I forget the name. You mentioned him at Mr. Fielding's. What my book calls Aurangzeb."
"Alamgir? Oh, yes. He was, of course, the more pious. But Babur, never in his whole life did he betray a friend. So I can only think of him this morning. And you know how he died? He laid down his life for his son, a death far more difficult than battle. They were caught in the heat. They should have gone back to Kabul for the bad weather, but could not for reasons of state. And at Agra, Humayun fell sick. Babur walked round the bed 3 times and said, 'I have borne it away.' And he did bear it away. The fever left his son and came to him instead, and he died.
That is why I prefer Babar to Alamgir. I ought not to do so, but I do. However, I mustn't delay you. I see you are ready to start.
Not at all, she said, sitting down by Mrs. Moore again. We enjoy talk like this very much.
For at last he was talking about what he knew and felt, talking as he had in Fielding's garden house. He was again the Oriental guide whom they appreciated. At the end of it, Godbole said,
May I now take my leave?
Always an indication that he had not come to his point yet.
Now I take my leave. I must tell you how glad I am to hear that after all you succeeded in reaching the Meribah. I feared my unpunctuality had prevented you. But you went a far pleasanter method in Miss Derrick's car. I hope the expedition was a successful one.
The news has not reached you yet, I can see.
Oh, yes.
No, there has been a terrible catastrophe about Aziz.
Oh, yes, that is all round the college.
Well, the expedition where that occurs can scarcely be called a successful one, said Fielding with an amazed stare.
I cannot say. I was not present.
He stared again, a most useless operation, for no eye could see what lay at the bottom of the Brahmin's mind. And yet he had a mind and a heart, too, and all his friends trusted him without knowing why.
I am most frightfully cut up, he said.
So I saw at once on entering your office. I must not detain you, but I have a small private difficulty on which I want your help. I am leaving your service shortly, as you know.
Yes, alas.
And am returning to my birthplace in central India to take charge of education there. I want to start a high school there on sound English lines that shall be as like government college as possible.
Well, he sighed, trying to take an interest.
At present, there is only vernacular education at Mau. I shall feel it my duty to change all that. I shall advise His Highness to sanction at least a high school in the capital, and if possible, another in each Pargana.
Fielding sunk his head on his arms. Really, Indians were sometimes unbearable.
The point on which I desire your help is this. What name should be given to the school?
A name? A name for a school?
He said, feeling sickish suddenly, as he had done in the waiting room.
Yes, a name, a suitable title by which it can be called, by which it may be generally known.
Really, I have no names for schools in my head.
The Nawab Bahadur had financed the defence, and would ruin himself sooner than let an innocent Muslim perish. And other interests less reputable were in the background, too. The case might go up from court to court, with consequences that no official could foresee. Under his very eyes, the temper of Chandrapur was altering. As his car turned out of the compound, there was a tap of silly anger on its paint, a pebble thrown by a child. Some larger stones were dropped near the mosque. In the Maidan, a squad of native police on motorcycles waited to escort them through the bazaars. The collector was irritated and muttered,
McBride's an old woman.
But Mrs. Turton said,
Really? After Moharram, a show of force will do no harm. It's ridiculous to pretend they don't hate us. Do give up that farce.
He replied in an odd, sad voice,
I don't hate them. I don't know why.
And he didn't hate them. For if he did, he would have had to condemn his own career as a bad investment. He retained a contemptuous affection for the pawns he had moved about for so many years. They must be worth his pains.
After all, it's our women who make everything more difficult out here, was his inmost thought, as he caught sight of some obscenities upon a long blank wall,
and beneath his chivalry to Miss Quested, resentment lurked, waiting its day. Perhaps there is a grain of resentment in all chivalry. Some students had gathered in front of the city magistrate's court, hysterical boys whom he would have faced if alone, but he told the driver to work round to the rear of the building. The students jeered, and Ruffy, hiding behind a comrade that he might not be identified, called out that the English were cowards.